Back together again, you and I chatting on a midweek Wednesday, November 29th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We continued our discussion of a delay in implementing an eventual end to gasoline-powered vehicle sales in the state. Landmark Legal Foundation Executive VP Matt Forries joined us again, this time to chat about a key Supreme Court case concerning federal tax collections. And we heard our usual midweek Wednesday update from Hearst Connecticut Media columnist and editor Dan Haar. So I took some time after we got off the air yesterday, went home, relaxed, had dinner, and I pulled up all the stories I could regarding, as you heard Chris say today and yesterday during the show, the governor pulling the plug, at least for the time being, on this plan that would have phased out in the way it was set up to go into effect, that would have phased out gasoline-powered car sales in the state completely by 2035 and started that phase out in just 4 years. Remember, 2035 was the penultimate end of this thing. 2027, only 4 years from now, was going to be the beginning of it for trucks and some cars and whatever. So, you know, last night and early today and even now leading up to showtime, but last night I pulled up all the stories I could on this. And the more I read this, the more I'm convinced that what a lot of you folks did, and this is not the first time this has happened, it happened with the tolls too. If you remember a couple of years ago, thank God, it happened with the tolls too. And this is slowly starting to show the powers that be in all branches of government, but especially the tone-deaf Democratic majority in this state, that if you and I, if we the people think something is dumb, we will go to the ends of God's green earth to make sure to do our level best that we see it doesn't happen. It doesn't mean that it eliminates a problem that must be taken care of. No, on the contrary. It allows people to say, hey, okay, we elect you, but we also have the freedom in this state and in this country to tell you, we don't think you're doing this right. Because you're doing this, as my dearly departed Italian father would say, half-assed. Now, why do I say that? Well, that's a little harsh, Paul. Well, is it or is it not? Because I like I said, I reread these stories last night and the early part of today when I got in the station. And I noticed something really weird here, that a lot of the majority Democrats in Hartford, you know, Matt Ritter, Amart Looney from New Haven, Bob Duff from Norwalk, everybody's like, well, okay, maybe there were some problems here. Well, here's my question. Simple question. If now you're admitting that some of these problems existed, either in that regulation that was going to be likely enacted yesterday until a couple of Democrats said, hey, forget it, this ain't working out the way we want it. If now you are suddenly saying, hey, there are some problems here, then why did you go ahead with it at all? In other words, if talk show hosts like myself and conservative columnists like myself and people like the Yankee Institute and concerned people like you folks out there, if you didn't put up a stink about it, that's a all-encompassing word, I think we know where that comes from, but if you didn't put up a stink about this, it would have went through. So my question here, and I'm going to read you some of these comments again because you hear these and you go, huh? Really? So, was this bad or not? And if it was less than people expected, would there have been the 7 Democratic votes on the Regulations Review Committee, the panel there, that would have outweighed the 7 Republican votes and allowed this plan to go into effect? My guess is maybe it would have been. So then what would have happened to these problems and these concerns that suddenly, heading into an election year, ding, 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 suddenly those in the majority of Hartford have seen Jesus on this. Oh, the Lord cometh. Here's a couple of things in the Connecticut Mirror. Connecticut Mirror here first. Let me start. There's also some good stuff here in the Connecticut News Junkie. Essentially, it was from the same news conference yesterday of the Democratic leadership in Hartford. And the usual folks were out there. Martin Looney. I've known Martin Looney, friend. I've talked to him for 30 years or something like that. Whatever. I think Marty had lunch with Lincoln at one time. I don't know. Just kidding, Marty. Love you. He said, quote, yesterday, this was at a big news conference, a newser, a presser, a newser, as we call it in the news business. This happened in Hartford. Quote, we know that the gasoline-powered car is certainly on its way out. Okay, yeah, I think he's probably right. Given time, I don't think it'll ever be completely on the way out, but given time, whatever. I'm sure there will be continued improvements to internal combustion engines that may make them virtually pollution-free. Who knows? But I digress. We will have all electric vehicles in the future. Well, Marty, you don't know that. You don't know that. The vast majority of them will be. I don't know if they're going to be all electric, but I digress. And we want to make that future happen as soon as we can. Huh? And we want to make that future happen as soon as we can. Well, wait a minute here. If we want to make the future happen as soon as we can, then does that still make it the future? Sorry. Just like I'm wondering, you know, Yogi Berra, when you see a fork in the road, take it. Just saying. Now, here's my question. I'm kidding. I've known Marty for years. But here's something he said yesterday. And I'm pointing this out because I'm just trying to point out the hypocrisy here. If you're going to stand for something, stand for something. That's fine. I give anybody credit on the left or the right, blue or the red. You want to stand for something, good on you. The worst thing you can be is in the middle of the road. Well, we should be middle of the road. Well, a lot of times if you're in the middle of the road, you know what happens? You get run over. Be on one side or the other and embrace it. Looney said, quote, we also have to make sure it happens in an equitable way, not leaving any community behind. Well, okay, so here's my question. Maybe you have an answer. This question is a little rhetorical. At 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. So now you have Marty Looney and the governor and Matt Ritter and Bob Duff all up there in Hartford yesterday worried about this has to happen in an equitable way. Well, wait a minute. If Kathy Austin and Joan Hartley, the two Democrats who were going to be no votes on this and kill it, if they were yes votes, would you still have been worried about this being equitable? You see what I mean here by words? It's almost like they're agreeing with the opposition only because they have to. Because they got caught with their, not literal, but figuratively, they got caught with their political pants down. I mean, down around the ankles, like you're sitting on the throne. If you know what I mean. Now, here's where Marty, and again, I've known Marty for years, but this is typical index card, Democratic claptrap, just psychobabble. Looney blamed the failure to adopt their regulations on Republicans, and kudos to the Connecticut Mirror here, as they point out, while ignoring the role of members of his own caucus. So Marty Looney is sitting there blaming Republicans when it was two members of his own Democratic caucus, Joan Hartley and Kathy Austin, who would have been the no votes on this. So even, and Marty knows this, and Matt Ritter knows this, and Bob Duff knows this, so they're going to blame Republicans anyway. Now, you know what? Why they're blaming Republicans? Because Republicans started shouting from the mountaintops on this, and the hillsides, and wherever you can shout from, hey, this doesn't make any sense the way it's written for Connecticut right now. So they're the Democratic leadership in Hartford, make no mistake, folks. They are, I can imagine their anger, their vitriolic, acidic thoughts today that how dare the other side in Connecticut who, you know, which we, the Democrats, outnumber by 2-1 and 3-1 in Hartford. How dare they tell people, hey, there's something wrong with this plan? And how dare two people from our side of the aisle, Kathy Austin and Joan Hartley, say, hey, we're not comfortable with this either. Martin Luwanese said, quote, the Republican Party, unfortunately, is the party of no without thought, no without a plan. No, Marty, it's your side that doesn't have the plan. But you're flailing away because you've been there forever and you are disconnected from two-thirds of this state, the Republicans and the independents in this state. But the administration withdrew the regulations, it says here. So this is a good balance piece in the Connecticut Mirror. They're pointing out, hey, Marty Looney and other Democrats can say what they can say what they want and scream and yell about the Republicans. Kevin Kelly. But it says here in the Connecticut Mirror, obviously, the writer for the Mirror here, the writers are calling out the Democrat BS here, the fertilizer, the Vigorol. But the administration withdrew the regulations only after concluding the two Senate Democrats, Kathy Austin of Sprague and Joan Hartley of Waterbury, were prepared to vote with all seven Republicans against the regulations. Austin was among the two dozen lawmakers at the news conference, but she made no remarks. I wouldn't be surprised if they told her, Kathy, you stand there and shut up. But I want to shut up. Folks, this is I am thoroughly enjoying this. Can you tell? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. I'm telling you. They must be just beside themselves in Hartford. And good. Every so often, the power structure in the state needs to be shaken up. And good on you and good on the people that respectfully call the governor's office, call the office of your state rep or your state senate member, and sent respectful, hopefully, emails saying, you know, don't do this. And I'm telling you, don't stop doing that. Not only on this issue, but keep an eye as to what they're going to do on this starting in January. Now, they're afraid. They are clearly afraid. Because think about what the power of the media has done, what talk radio has done, what columnists in the state have done, what some Republican legislators have done. They've at least put a stop on this for now to where it needs to get reworked a little bit and be a better idea, maybe adopting what some other states did and putting some benchmarks here as we do this. That's a good idea. So you folks who are responsible for that, and the media and talk radio and the columnists, remember, they kill tolls, too. And I can tell you, I have sources at the Capitol who tell me they still have never gotten over that. Before we go to traffic and weather together, Dave and Meriden. Dave, what's up with you?
Hey, Paul, how you doing? Hey. Nice to have you back. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
I did. Thank you, Dave.
I did contact the governor's office last week.
Yeah.
Spoke to an aide, told him I was, you know, very upset about the possibility of this happening, and left a message. And I'm sure a lot of other people must have done the same thing, so we got to keep on their backs.
Absolutely. And David, thank you, and good to hear from you again. Yeah, folks, listen, it's not just this, and it just wasn't tolls. This should be the activism with taxes, with the law enforcement in the state. And again, remember the governor's office is the sexy target to go after every 4 years. You can more easily alter the way the state of Connecticut is run and governed every 2 years when you take a few minutes to figure out who your state senate member is or who your state house representative is and keep an eye on them and tell them. I say this all the time. If you are not happy with a vote on anything, you email them, you call them and say, you know what, you disappointed me. I will remember this on Election Day. That's all. You be courteous. You say it with a smile. And if enough of that happens, as we've seen with tolls and as we've seen with this right now, sometimes it works. All right, we'll get back to open phones later on this hour. When we do that, it'll, of course, be at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We've had this gentleman on the program before a few times to talk about things, all things legal, especially when it comes to the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. There is a case right now, I guess, that's going to be argued in front of the court coming up in the next couple of weeks, a couple of days, I guess it's December something, that there are people saying that depending upon how the high court rules on this and what they say in the ruling and whatever legal wiggle room they leave or don't leave, this could end up costing the federal government hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in tax revenue. Now, there are some people crying foul about that, others saying, no, that would be a good thing. Matt Forries joins us. He's Executive VP of the Landmark Legal Foundation. Hey, Matt, Paul here in Connecticut. How are you, sir?
Have me on.
Hey, Matt, how are you? You broke up there a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm doing great. Hope you are, too.
Oh, thank you, sir. Now I can hear you. So, Matt, explain this case, because, I'm reading everything from, hey, it's high time this case was heard, to, oh, my God, the sky is falling, and this could crumble the U.S. Explain this case to my listeners.
Sure. So, it's going to be on December 5th. The Supreme Court's going to hear oral argument. It's Moore versus United States. And it is a critically important tax case. It's going to impact the federal taxation of not just income, but wealth. So quick review of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
Husband and wife, the Moores, they befriended someone at work here in the United States. And that man's dream was to set up a business back in India to serve farmers. So he set up a company called Kiss and Craft. The Moores bought shares, ultimately had 13% of the company stock.
Okay.
Over the years, the business was successful, but it used the earnings and profits to expand. And the business never paid out any dividends to the Moores or to any of the shareholders. So back in 2017, Congress passed a law that changed the international tax structure. One of the important points here was shareholders of certain foreign corporations were on the hook for a proportional share of the company's earnings, potentially going all the way back to 1987, which is just absolutely outrageous, okay? But the Moores, even though they had never received a penny in dividends, even though they had never sold their shares and made a profit, they were hit with a tax bill. And so we argue that's not a tax on income, that's a tax on wealth.
Because they never, in other words, is that what we call, and Matt, forgive me if I'm wrong here, is that what economists and tax people say, unrealized gains or capital gains? In other words, in theory, it's there, but they never really cashed it out. Am I correct in that?
That's absolutely right. So the difference between wealth and income, you know, you bought your house 20 years ago for $200,000. If you sold it today, you get $1 million. So over that time, your net worth has increased $800,000. But if you don't sell the house, you don't have any income. You don't realize the gain, that, to use the terminology of tax law,
mm-hmm.
like you said. So here, the government is arguing that realization is not a constitutional requirement for the definition of income. But that flies in the face of the original and plain meaning of the word income in the 16th Amendment to the Constitution.
Wow. Matt Forries is the guest, Executive VP of the Landmark Legal Foundation. So so in other words, when the High Court hears this, Matt, and I know you folks at Landmark Legal and other people can usually almost immediately judge, hey, which way the court is leaning here. Who do you expect to maybe have the most piercing questions here or to really try and drive this case either way on both sides? Or could this be, Matt, something that unites the conservative or liberal justices? How do you see this playing out?
Well, what's interesting, now that you mention it, is the Chief Justice, Justice Roberts, has a history of really muddying the waters on tax law. If you remember, back in the Obamacare case, He said that the individual mandate penalty under Obamacare could be upheld as a tax.
Yeah.
And his theory was it was an excise tax, like gasoline taxes, he said, but it's just like an excise on not buying tax. And that was an incredible stretch, but it shows the lengths he'll go sometimes to get the result he wanted. And obviously, the Obamacare case was a huge political case that affected the current president, and he was trying to keep the court out of politics. So he can be results-oriented. Unfortunately, you know, the leftist-leaning justices, they'll probably vote in lockstep on this because this is really coming at the heart of government,
mm-hmm.
right? The ability to fund government is just essential for their big government schemes. You know, we know Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, they've all put out wealth tax plans, right? They've all proposed that. They would love to be able to tax the accumulated wealth of the rich, not just their annual income, but their accumulated wealth. But, you know, there aren't enough billionaires in the United States to fund their ideas. Even if you took every penny from Elon Musk and Bill Gates,
mm-hmm.
we'd only keep the government running a few days. So ultimately, the left is going to have to come after the middle class to fund big government. And that's why this case is so important.
Matt Forese is the guest executive vice president at the Landmark Legal Foundation. We look to them to get their input on the conservative end of things vis-a-vis the U.S. Supreme Court. So the fear is here, Matt, by many on the left and even some left of center folks say, oh, my God, if the court says, this can happen going back to that 2016 or 17 law, then is the left fearing that this would put the kibosh on some of these plans to tax wealth as it stands right now? How would this affect Congress legislatively, and maybe even some of my listeners here who may not be billionaires but may have personal wealth tied up in a small business or a couple of homes they own? What would this mean to the common person listening right now?
Right. So just so everyone knows, the Constitution has a few procedural hurdles, like the apportionment clause, that make taxes on wealth as opposed to taxes on income very difficult to implement.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress does have power. It's just that there are some limits on them. There are very few of them remaining. And if I could just quickly, what are the apportionment clause and the direct tax clauses?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little known aspect of the Constitution today because it's almost like a settled question, but it was vitally important in the early days of the Republic. We fought a war with Great Britain because we believe there should be a link between taxation and representation, right? You should be able to have someone in Congress or the Parliament to be able to have a say in whether or not you're going to vote in taxes.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So under the Constitution, a certain type of taxes, direct taxes, have to be apportioned by population, the way congressional seats are apportioned by population.
Okay.
So if you pass a direct tax, a state with twice the population as another state pays double the tax. Okay, and what are direct taxes? Direct taxes are things like poll taxes,
mm-hmm.
and that's like a tax on someone directly, or a tax on your land or your house. Those are the classic understanding of what a direct tax is. But generally, you know, it should be broader than that to include what your bank account. You know what I mean? If it's someone just coming after your wealth and your property. And there's another aspect too. Going back to the early days, you know, during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Army had to go to the states for funding.
Sure.
You know, and so the Army, they were sitting without shoes at Valley Forge in the wintertime waiting for money that wasn't coming in. So Alexander Hamilton was one of these early proponents to make sure the Constitution had the power to go to the people, bypassing the states for taxes and emergencies. But that apportionment clause acted as a compromise. And also, you know, they thought at the time that indirect taxes like tariffs and gas taxes, excises, mm-hmm. would be enough to fund the national government because it's going to be so small. And that has obviously changed. Now we're in massive $1 trillion deficit.
Matt, one last thing here. Now, you could fit my knowledge of tax policy and economics on the head of a pin, but one thing does stick out to me here. Taxation of income, we all understand that, but taxation mm-hmm. of wealth. Now, Who is to determine, let's say the left got this through Congress, let's say there was enough wiggle room left by the high court, okay, we're going to tax your wealth and your business. Well, who puts a value, Matt Forhees, on that wealth? You know, income is income. You made $100,000
right
last year. So, but you own a business. Well, okay, or you have shares. Well, what's, like, how do you determine what that wealth is worth, which could change day to day, hour to hour?
Absolutely. So you're raising one of the great arguments against this kind of tax plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult, or much more difficult, to implement as opposed to income tax. And also, you know, you can find someone is doesn't have a lot of cash. Like, you might own a farm and it's not doing so well at the moment, and then you have to sell the farm in order to pay the tax.
Yeah.
So it causes like this liquidity spiral for some people. But generally, you know, what would happen is similar to the way we deal with property taxes at the state level. I'm not sure if you have them up in Connecticut, but you know, you have a local assessor comes out and says,
yeah,
this is what your house is worth, you know? So they had some, you know, some situations like that in the early days of the Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you can imagine having a system like that around the country.
God.
Would be an enormous undertaking.
Yeah, but at least assessors would get the jobs out of this. Matt Forhees, Matt, thanks. Check it out. Landmark Legal Foundation. Again, this big case. What was the date of that? December 5th, you said the oral arguments are?
Yes.
All
December
right.
5th. And if you'd like to read our brief,
sure,
and our background, we're at landmarklegal.org.
All right. Matt, thanks. Good to speak with you. Matt, take care. We'll be in touch down the road. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for
all
having
me. All right. So there you go. Matt Forhees, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. If you're a tax person, if you're a lawyer, huge case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court coming up on December 5th. Because, again, folks, there are a lot of Democrats in Congress, I don't think any Republican is for this, but they want to go beyond taxing your income. They want to tax your wealth. Well, what is your wealth? Even if you've never sold those shares of stock or sold that house, but you still have, there are arguments that, well, you have that wealth and it can be liquidated or can turn liquid if you need it, if you have medical bills or whatever, if you just want to retire. So you should be there. This, I don't believe this. Now, it's one thing if you sell it and cash it in. But there is a notion by some in D.C. and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. He, you know, Matt was right there, and they're very vocal about this. They want to they want a wealth tax. And their argument is, well, the wealthy can live on their estate. It's not just about, you know, their income. A lot of them have live off capital gains and live off the sales of stock and all that. So beyond taxing the sale of stock and the cashing in of assets, we should also tax stuff that maybe that person is not touching for whatever reason. All right, as usual, back to open phones in just a bit later on this hour. When we do that, of course, now the number didn't change. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Back on a midweek Wednesday. We took a week off last week, so back to have Dan Haar with us, Hearst Connecticut Media editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Happy 90th anniversary of the end of Prohibition.
Oh, is that today? Was that today?
Yeah, we had a story about it, yes.
Oh, excellent. Nice. Oh, 90.
And
boy.
Of course, Connecticut was one of two states, the other being Rhode Island, that never ratified Prohibition.
Wait a minute. We never ratified. So was it technically then okay to drink in Connecticut during that or not?
It was not. The amendment in 1919 was ratified,
yeah,
with two-thirds of the states, not in, and with more than two-thirds of the states. Connecticut and Rhode Island not among them.
Oh, see, Dan, the stuff I learned from having you on, it's wonderful. So let's talk about this car thing. Dan, this is fascinating Because we all know, and you wrote this in one of your pieces, this is eventually going to happen. This is like turning a battleship. And I've said 100 times on my show, Dan, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we are going to see electric vehicles. As the technology gets better, they're going to be in the mainstream here. But the fascinating angle, Dan Haar, that I find about this came in the aftermath at some of these news conferences where, you know, Marty Looney is waving his finger, as he usually does. I've known Marty for 30, 35 years. But then you have Matt Ritter all of a sudden and some of the other Democrats saying, well, you know, Dan, maybe we have to take into account some of these concerns. So, you know, the tap dancing on this, Dan, has been fascinating over the past 2 or 3 days.
Well, Senator Looney has not been despite what he says, he has not been an outstanding advocate for environmental legislation, mostly because he knows correctly that his urban constituents may be forced to pay the price financially, even though it is also the case that his urban constituents would typically face environmental injustice. That is, many environmental ills are foisted on cities. So it is an already complicated issue that is made all the more complicated in Connecticut's cities. And if you look at Senator Looney's comments yesterday, he definitely did equivocate on this. He said, we want to see it, but we need to see. And Senator and Representative Ritter, Speaker Ritter, said the same thing.
Yeah.
We want to see these standards applied. We need to move forward aggressively, but we need to do so carefully. And that's what the legislature is going to do, either in a special session before February, which I doubt, or in the regular session.
Or do you think, Dan Haar, the cynic in me, saying, well, you know, 2024, Dan, all the seats in the House and Senate are up for re-election. Do you think maybe we're going to do the old extended study here again and put this off till the odd year in 2025? What do you think?
Well, you really can't, because the thresholds start in 2027. And so it's remember, this passed in an election year of 2022, and the Democrats did fine. I think There's a lot of debate. I know the Yankee Institute, my friends at the Yankee Institute have made a big deal of the fact that it is incorrect to say that the public comments were heavily in favor of this change. But the reality is that there's a lot of public confusion, A, and B, support for the transition. The question is, how much will it cost me, and will we be ready? But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's my point. Connecticut needs to be ready. In order to get ready, Connecticut needs to set aggressive targets. The EPA targets are aggressive-ish, but not really aggressive. The California targets are aggressive, period. Zero new small trucks and cars sold with gasoline engines after 2035, after the 2035 model year. Or actually, I think it's in the 2035 model year. So it's aggressive, and you need to have aggressive targets. And one of the things that the legislature is going to do probably this year, not wait to do, is say, we're going to give ourselves a safety valve. We're going to go back, and that's what Colorado and New Mexico have done. We're going to give ourselves an out where in 2 years we'll revisit it. And if we're not making progress on the infrastructure, which is the problem, we will pull back out.
And I think most people would be okay with that, Dan. You know, and finally, you know, and I think I caught a couple of comments on the lead up to this by, you know, people at Eversource and UI saying, hey, we can make all these infrastructure changes. The sooner the better we start. But hello, we're going to need rate increases for this because what we're looking at are billions of dollars in upgrades.
Well, it isn't necessarily that they're saying we're going to need rate increases. It's that they're saying we're going to need money. Because remember, if they do the upgrades will carry more electrons.
Mm-hmm.
They will carry more electricity. When they carry more electricity, it is not necessarily a per kilowatt hour increase that they need. It's just that they remember there are two things that electric companies look for. One is rate increases, and the other is volume increases.
Yeah.
And so and that's oversimplifying. I get it. But the bottom line here is this. The Republicans have outfoxed the Democrats on this issue by portraying this as a matter of choice. That is not 99% nonsense. It is 100% nonsense. And the Democrats need to get off their fat duffs and stop allowing that to happen and make the clear point that there isn't going to be an internal combustion engine in a car after 2035 because Ford, GM, Toyota, and Honda aren't going to sell them. So stop calling it a choice and call it a progression, and Connecticut will either be ready or it won't. And they're so namby-pamby about this and so afraid of being called anti-choice that they can't get out of their own way.
Here's my prediction, Dan Harn, before we go to this financial report. Here's my prediction. I think, I don't know whether there's going to be no internal combustion engines sold in the country or in the U.S., but I'll tell you, there's going to be a lot of hybrids out there. And did I misread this, Dan Harr? Do hybrids count in this thing or not? Because, you know, the head of Toyota, he's a big hybrid guy. He's like, nobody's going to buy into this EV thing full on unless you let them have a hybrid first.
Hybrids count. And if you want to take a risk and drive around in a hydrogen vehicle, they count too. I don't know if I would do that.
Hydrogen. Jeez. All right, Dad, you wanted to mention this, and I must have missed this, the financial accountability report. What's that about?
Yes, it's called the financial accountability report. It comes out every November, and it is essentially the annual ledger of the state of Connecticut.
Okay.
And when we look 5 years out, really, we look 3 years past the current biennium. So it's this year, next year, and the three following years that we look at. And we see some things that we like, and we see some things that we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we see that we like is that in significant part because of the $7.6 billion pay down of additional payments to the pensions, we are saving $650 million a year.
Wow.
And so that we already knew. But as a result of that, the new prediction in this report, the sort of headline news, is that we're not digging into a hole anymore on the budget. That is to say that the growth in the cost of fixed costs, such as Medicaid and pensions and health care, the things that you have to pay for, the growth in those costs is smaller than the growth in tax revenues, right?
Oh,
and, of course, Republicans say, great, cut taxes. And we've been cutting taxes, not as much as people would like to have seen, because we wanted to pay down the pensions. The downside of this is it looks like the gravy train is ending. It looks like the huge tax surpluses, budget surpluses, are coming to an end. This year's surplus is whittling down and down and down. And when it moves down in one, when it starts to move down in the first 6 months of the year, it doesn't tend to reverse itself. But you will remember in the last 3 years, by December, the budget surplus projected was bigger than what had been planned in June. Right. So now it is smaller.
Yeah.
I won't go into the numbers. But the long and the short of it is that's the good news and the bad news. And don't look for any tax cuts this year. And also, if don't look for any additional spending, because we have rules on spending that both the moderate Democrats and the Republicans all want to stick to, and the liberal Democrats do not want to stick to.
Yeah, and I want to end with that, Dan. That's exactly where I wanted to go. So it looks like Governor Lamont, at least for the near future, Dan is going to be able to sit back, and whether or not he runs for another term, he's going to say, I told you so, right? Not like not everything's wonderful, but this is what we have to do.
Well, everybody is saying, I told you so. The Republicans are saying, I told you so, because they were the ones who forced the agreement in 2017 that led to these great reforms, that led to the $7.6 billion pay down, and that led to the spending controls. Governor Lamont wasn't there in 2017, but subscribes fully to it.
Mm-hmm.
He is a classic country club Republican who now we call those Democrats.
Yeah, Dan Harr, Dan, thanks. Of course, read his stuff, all the Hearst Connecticut media publications. Our buddy Dan Harr. Dan, be good. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Great to be here. Have a good rest of the week.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Harr there. Yeah, Country Club Republican, right? The old Fairfield County, Greenwich, Fairfield, Stamford Republican. Those days are gone, right? I was reading a story about that. I think it was linked to on our buddy Tom Dudchik's site, CT Capital Report, about how the demographics are changing in this state. And it's fascinating because people, on, especially conservatives or Republicans, they get angry because, oh, my God, another Democrat won another. Well, you know what? Again, this weaves into my theory here. It's not so much a theory. I think it's true. The political preferences of people have to do with demographics, have to do with race, have to do with immigration, migration, and their lived lives here. And this isn't 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago when Fairfield County was mostly beet red, when New Haven County was purplish, when, you know, Hartford County was kind of blue, and those areas, it changes. And good politicians and good politicos, they take a step back. And this is what I mean when, you know, the Republicans again engage in these circular firing squads, pandering to a small amount of people, relatively, who decide nominees. Now, the Democrats do that too, but they don't shoot each other in the foot or in the face. Like, again, I've said numerous times, you get a little Democratic uprising on the national level or even on the state level for about a day or two. Then somebody in the Democratic caucus, whether it's in your city or town or in Hartford or in D.C., they trot out the tried and true Italian phrase, "Statezitte," right? I heard that as a kid growing up. When you heard that, when mom or dad or your aunt or your uncle said, "Oh, fa, statezitte," that means shut up. Shut up. Republicans don't do that. In fact, a perfect example. Remember I was talking yesterday about why are we going into the Donald Trump saying, "Oh, we're going to replace Obamacare. We're doing this again." And there's stories all over the mainstream sites today, The Hill and Politico. Of course, they went up to Senate Republicans in D.C. yesterday, last night and this morning, some of whom after a run for re-election, say, "Hey, Donald Trump said you guys, if he gets re-elected, are going to get rid of Obamacare." And they're like, oh,